So we've been investigating the six paramitas, the first two already, generosity and morality. And today we're leapfrogging over tolerance and patience. Just skip it. And we're moving right into energy. Or is it Virya? Anybody know the Sanskrit? Virya? Mm-hmm. All right.
Perseverance and diligence is what I call it.
Okay. The actual Sanskrit word means manliness, valor, strength, power, energy. So I'm going to use the word energy. I haven't figured out the pronunciation yet. So the first three are perfections, generosity, morality, and patience or tolerance are really paramitas for everybody. Anyone can practice them. Whereas when we move into energy, meditation, and wisdom, there is a shift, and that shift has to do with a person's priority in their life. So as you turn your life towards this Buddha way, then energy is part of that process, part of that stage. So now, there's a phrase that says, when there's energy, there's enlightenment, and vice versa. Enlightenment, where there's enlightenment, there's energy. So, for early Buddhists, what energy was viewed as was energy of accomplishment, energy of effort, courage, power. And that energy was something that would sustain the practitioner all the way from the beginning through the middle and then, of course, to full awakening. Arya Sura, who wrote the Jathamalal, which are the tales of the Buddha in former lives, often use the paramitas as material for the stories. And, of course, energy was right there in there. But he defined the perfection of energy as striving without weariness in the practice of good.
Striving without what?
Striving without weariness in the practice of good. We could identify several different kinds of energy. Well, not kinds as much as maybe levels of energy, or more as they relate to, you know, their function. So energy and stamina to actually protect oneself, to protect the practitioner as they're experiencing difficult times. And also to help avoid or not fall into depression. Then the next one is energy to experience and express enthusiasm and good spirits on the path. And of course, the third would be for the practice of and for the benefit of all beings. So the question is, how does this energy happen? Well, the early sutras give us a very little information. What is present in the early sutras is really more in the forms of encouragement and acknowledgement, you know, kind of inspirational talks about energy, rather than any specific techniques. So I think we're on our own. You know, we have to figure this out. So The two forms of energy we could consider physical and mental. And really, on this path, you need both. So when they're united, along with the vow to liberate all beings, you can see that those two types of energy actually with applied effort are what begins this process of somehow, you know, creating the energy that's needed to continue to pursue the goal of awakening for yourself and all beings. By the third and fourth stage on the Bodhisattva path, the work that one does is characterized as effortless. And some of us may say, well, you know, how does that feel? What does that, you know, look like? Effortless. And I was thinking about how the moon reflects the sun effortlessly. It just is. It reflects the sun. So we could say that would be in the later stage of development of a bodhisattva, effortlessly practicing for the benefit of all beings. There is a difference between ordinary energy and supermundane, or ordinary and extraordinary, or mundane versus supermundane. And this is something we may have talked about yesterday or a day before, which is about the turning over of merit. And it's, as I said, I think then, it's a spontaneous turning over of merit. And it definitely marks a transition from the practices that you may have engaged in your earlier training. And now as you apply energy in your practice, you may notice this shift. As you have energy and through your own efforts, you see others needing that energy, and you can offer it as a gift for their welfare and for their awakening. In the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, there's two criteria regarding the perfection of energy, and the first one is selfless compassion. And this, you know, is associated with the turning over of merit. And the second is wisdom, prajna. So this is when we move into wisdom, we're now moving into emptiness. And so we would say that the bodhisattva seeks energy on behalf of all beings, which are also empty. And of course, even the energy is empty. So, all lack own being. In other words, are not self-produced, but arise in dependence on something else. So this, sometimes some of our chants use the term own being, and it basically means that nothing. A bodhisattva knows that nothing is self-produced. In other words, it always is dependent on something else. So one question that might come up is like, well, what's the optimal state? I mean, how much energy do you really need to carry out this work? And we know it seems to require much more work than just to carry out the function of everyday life, because now you have this vow to liberate all beings and yourself. So there is, of course, the element of discipline. It's Not to say that we, as practitioners, are devoid of emotion. Rather, probably some of you have heard the more popular term emotional intelligence, which indicates a level of maturity about the way you're responding to what is needed through use of the energy that you have accumulated in your practice. So I think it's, I want to say Shantideva, who speaks of the need for courage in arousing energy, and actually carrying on the work at this stage of practice. And one needs this courage because, you know, it takes effort. It's, you know, it's an arduous practice to, obviously, sitting here for how many days, how many sittings, 9 sittings a day, and, you know, that takes effort. It's arduous practice. So hopefully the energy that you're applying in this is also returning back to you, so you can, of course, continue to practice so intensely. Now, at this stage, there's also some other trait that's associated with energy, and it's called confidence. And it's not confidence that's associated with vanity or with conceit. It's definitely confidence. And it's confidence in a way one wouldn't expect. It's confidence in that you are now rooted in your practice and in the universal, in oneness. And that kind of confidence is what really allows you to continue to practice this way so wholeheartedly. Because it's like a way of knowing that this is the path for you. And it actually helps set aside maybe some concerns of doubt that you might have about, is this really the right practice for me? Is this really, am I going to experience liberation? So it's offers one the possibility of this self-assurance that you are on the right path, that this does lead to liberation. And also, it helps in reducing the self-clinging that one has as a part of primal ignorance in, you know, being a human being. Of course, you know, there are others, aversion and delusion. So the confidence, the self-confidence actually helps in all of those aspects, because you are able to, I believe, put aside some mental machinations on, you know, should I do this? What's it going to do? You know, you kind of, this whole thing of, you know, being on the fence. You know, you're not on the fence anymore. You're on the path. And you know it. And, you know, each time you practice, that confidence intensifies and grows. And it's a great gift. It's a great gift. So this energy is a strengthening kind of power that's supports one on the path. And it's you know, it of course goes beyond just, you know, understanding the teachings and, you know, being of service in this practice. And so it, in the sense that it also supports you in your interactions with others so that you can be much more mindful and caring towards others. Because you have now also worked on patience or tolerance, and so now you have that support as well. So you can see in some way how each of the paramitas builds on the other and just continues to blossom at each level with intensity and I would say realization about the nature of reality. So we on Thursday, that is what day are we? Tuesday night we talked about this other kind of energy now we know about. It's called the Hingsposa, right? It's another energy field. But there's also other energy, and we know about kinetic energy, we know about gravitational energy. And so we have all these kinds of energies, and we know that the amount of energy is constant. That's still true?
As I know.
Okay. The physicist speaks. All right. So in our practice, as energy is experienced in your own life, then directs some of that energy towards others in your practice. That's what the paramita is an expression of. It's using that energy for the benefit of others and not to relinquish it in kind of a more mundane way. You know, recognize it when it comes and then apply it appropriately. So now I have some questions for you. Have any of you experienced this energy in your practice? Any kind of applied energy?
Samadhi?
Has it resulted in energy for you?
It's a positive ongoing, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And also, another way of describing it is practicing mindfulness continuously,
mm-hmm.
which Thich Nhat Hanh uses to describe this particular paramita.
Uh-huh.
Or maybe it's somebody else. Maybe it's Milarepa.
Definitely mindfulness is at this stage, I think it's very important that because as you're moving through everyday activities, the more mindful one is, actually the deeper your experience of life is. It's very interesting.
I notice it because of the contrast, because when I don't have energy, I'm not mindful, I don't have courage, I don't have confidence, you know, I can feel it dipping.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So that's the way I recognize it, is
mm-hmm.
like mm-hmm. a lot of time I spend down here,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then when I'm here, I know I'm not down there.
Feels different.
Yeah, and it's like I can feel how it'd be nice to be continuously mindful, but I haven't been able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes some mindfulness practices for yourself can help support you. When you see that energy level dipping, then you can choose a mindfulness practice and do it for about a week. Beyond that, you know, the mind doesn't want to do it anymore, so you might as well choose a new one. So it's, you know, we're just working with the mind. It's, doesn't want to be trained. So there's a really very good book out by Jan Chosen Bays. I highly recommend it. It's called How to Train a Wild Elephant. And there are many mindfulness practices that she brings up that help you. So I'll just give you an example of one. This is like on the light side. So this would be like a noticing the color blue for a week. So you get up in the morning, you set the intention to notice the color blue. And see, just take some notes for yourself. And see what happens when you notice. You'll notice that it shows up pretty regularly. It does. There's a lot of blue out there, more than you ever thought it was possible. Another would be to some of the more challenging ones, if you're up for these, would be like to consider defining and defending. So as you start your day, you set forth a vow to see if you can find instances when you define reality and defend your ego. Yeah. It's called defining and defending.
Could you give an example?
Oh, sure. Oh, yes, of course. So, okay.
It doesn't have to be personal. But
it's okay. So if I define myself in one way, you know, if I'm, I think that maybe I'm mindful, right? I might define myself that way. And then invariably to notice throughout the day that I'm not really mindful. You know, I just skated through, getting into the car, going to the center and, whatever. And I kind of missed the sunrise. You know, I missed the temperature of the air. I missed, there were a lot of things I missed. So, here I thought I was mindful and I just, totally blew off the whole, experience of transitioning from the home to the zendo, which, is less, 1 mile drive. And I totally missed, all aspects of that. So somewhere I was lost in my mind. I wasn't
so
really being mindful.
So how do you defend it?
Well, so if somebody says, well, they'll challenge you and say, well, you're not really mindful about that. You've been like my husband might tell me that I'm not really being too neat. I got my stuff all over the counters and I'm preparing for this weekend or whatever, and he'd just say, wow, you're not really very mindful. And I'd be like, maybe the first thing on my mouth is, well, how can you say that? I thought I was mindful, So all I'm saying is that I may not respond to what he just said verbally, but I may have to take it in and say, well, look around. It is pretty darn messy. You're not really being mindful about how you're stacking things up and putting things away, and it is pretty, pretty messy. So, probably where we might feel even more of the sting of when we define and defend ourselves would be around other characteristics, like people might say, well, you're really critical, or, you're this or that, and you don't really think you are. And you might have all kinds of excuses, or you might feel threatened, or, there are many things that could arise as a result of somebody pointing that out to you. Some of it doesn't even have to be actually spoken. You have a dialogue going on in your head, right? You're doing it, and it did, and it did, and So, you know, I'm just saying that these are, you know, mental conversations we're having, and we are defending ourselves. We are really defending some aspect of our ego. It's very interesting to see. Anyway, those would be some examples. So these practices you can probably tolerate about a week. One of them. I mean, you know, it isn't that you couldn't handle more. I mean, that the material is that questionable, but it's really more about the mind just, in a sense, gets bored. It doesn't want to pay attention anymore on that. It's like, been there, done that. I don't want to do that anymore. The novelty has worn off. So then you take another exercise, of which there are many. You could look at light, for example, and study light for a week. Or express gratitude. 5 things every night for a week. Write them down. And widen your circle of gratitude. So you can't repeat the same things every day.
Somebody's in the stove. Sorry.
The drumming and singing, you know, is going on. So, mindfulness. Thank you.
I thought of one other thing I'd like to mention. You were talking earlier about the energy that is sitting in sesshin. And I remember something from Ujjayini's text that said, I think it's Yoriki, is sort of a reinforcing energy, self-reinforcing. Mm-hmm. And it's also not personal energy, it's sort of the group. Because mm-hmm. there's no way you do this for days or a week, at least most of us have difficulty doing it at home alone.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of somehow supports the practice.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Thank you for that. Yes, it's certainly when I'm in this room, I can experience the energy of the room and the intensity of your practice. It's definitely clear to me that that's what's going on. So, of course, then I'll have to sit up straight. Do any of you notice this courage that you need? Have you experienced that courage? That some of your friends that don't know what the heck you do, you go off for a week, 5 days. What are you doing anyway? So your friends may question, you know, that or family. So that, you know, courage to just to do the practice is really needed, because you know, it's Buddhism is quite new in America, and not. Everyone understands what it is that we do. You face the wall? You do that a lot? You meditate? It's really surprising. But anyway, it's good to know that it's the energy that we get from each other. Actually, it's also the reason you are a member of a Sangha, and as opposed to sitting by yourself. The Sangha is there to support you in your practice. It's the only place sometimes you can talk about what's going on in your life, because people in your circle of family or friends don't really understand what your practice is. So having a Sangha is additional energetic support. Have any of you experienced this confidence that I spoke about?
I feel that my whole life transformed when I started practicing Zen. I was in a deep depression when I was 24, and struggling with candida, and just having a really hard time coping, like serious maelstroms of tears and like not wanting to be here anymore. And that practice of sitting up and open to peripheral vision and just starting to pay attention just was incredible fodder for being alive. And then it's just bloomed into just so much more joy and so much more ease in a really continuous way.
Mm-hmm. Excellent, yeah. Yeah, I think you describe what happens in the various stages, and it does really continue to get better. I believe your happiness level keeps going up, you know.
Right.
In my experience,
even just the brain chemistry thing, you know, and my parents, you know, I was raised Christian, and so when I went in for a residential training period at a pretty rigorous monastery I was practicing with in Canada, you know, my parents were a little antsy about it because they were like, what's this religious institution she's signing herself up for, you know? But I came out of there, and my dad, who, you know, I would say, you know, maybe a little bit less connected in general than my mom might be to my experience, you know, he said, that's the best thing you ever did, you know? Because he could see the change it elicited in just the... the capacity to learn that not our thoughts and our feelings are our states. It's just like, it's just such an incredible richness, you know? It's like, what better to be equipped with on this life journey, you know? Like, most people go through the world and they keep on believing all this garbage about who they think they are, and it's a travesty, you know?
Very much so. It's like, spent half of my life or more than, I don't know, I'm not knowing about this, you know, and it's, to me, I just can't believe that we don't teach this to children. So it's really something that for me is a really important aspect to share, because it's a great gift to know you're not your thoughts. You don't have to believe it. You know? Happiness is possible. You can make the choice. Yes.
The Shishin time where we put our attention to what's here, what we can decide where we put our attention. That's a real subtle thing. To put your attention somewhere, your breath or your thoughts or the wall or sounds. And then so you just do that again and again and again, and it's like, yeah. But then you go someplace else, like to lunch or yoki, and suddenly it's hilarious, and there is this huge energy that comes of like, what, this is wow, you know, and so there's that wow part of even just finishing the final knot of the and finding out somebody else is doing it is like one, you know, it just can get really. You can stretch things, stretch a moment, stretch your attention so that it just causes you to explode. So in a way, that's kind of when you explode with joy, that's a infusion of energy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like you're building a storehouse and stacking up all this kindling and build a big bonfire, but it's still this subtle... Mm-hmm. Stuff releases huge energies so I have no idea about it, you know, you just keep re-exploring it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it's
I think what you said about how it infuses or alters, you know, the whole time-space element is, I think, kind of interesting, because normally this practice, especially at this intensity, will break down your filters, you know, the way the mind will see things and take experiences in. And so, you know, we have this opportunity to expand. It naturally occurs in the... description you put forth here of that energy kind of exploding. So it's We're now in the third or fourth day. Which day is it? Third day.
Third full day.
Well, by now some of the filters are breaking down for people. And so we had, I don't know about you, but yesterday is more emotional for myself, and sometimes that usually can come up after an intense day or two. And so you have your, you know, the emotional thing, and then there's other kinds of distorted space and time language, or and things, you know, you keep looking back at a clock to find out what time is it, and it doesn't seem to register the time. It's very funny.
I had to hit that bell. I had to look at the clock about 4 or 5 times.
That's it. See? Time is distorted. And the memory of the time. It's just like it doesn't work anymore. Anyway. Well, enjoy your energy. Yeah, did you have something?
Yeah, just you mentioned about the like the emotional stuff, you know, coming up is it's like you're not doing anything, and then all of a sudden this energy of emotion that's really powerful smacks you, smacks me, and so how do you look at that energy?
Just experience it. I don't know if it's. It's just an expression. It's, you know, it's. I don't see it as, you know, positive or negative. It just goes on. It's just like a part of the process. So, it's interesting what shows up. You know, what's the content of that? You know. Maybe it's related to, you know, way back in your life, or it could be recent, you know, some kind of emotional experience or outpouring. Sometimes you feel like you're crying or other people laughing, or, you know, there's many different expressions of it. Yes?
Well, that brings me to a question I had when you were first talking, and you said there's mental energy and physical energy, and I was thinking there's a gap there. What about emotional energy? I mean, that's, I don't know. To me, that's a really real energy, unless I'm missing something.
No, they talk about that those two didn't exclude emotion, and that there is another component is emotional intelligence. So there is that knowing the appropriate response, and that includes emotions. It isn't like you're now at this stage devoid of emotion. It's what's the appropriate response. So also kind of is an indicator of level of maturity, emotional intelligence.
Right, but when, I guess the question is, when you talk about energy increasing, I mean, is that physical energy that increases, mental energy increases, emotional energy increases? I mean, or is it some other kind of energy that increases?
You know, I think it's, you know, all aspects, you know, all these kinds of energy. It's the point in terms of your character development is the appropriateness of the response.
Physical, mental, and emotional.
Right, and so that is, so it, with the appropriate response, then taking it to the level of perfection is also to acknowledge the emptiness of it. So the emptiness of the energy of the person, yourself, of energy, you know, it's that there is no separation in all of this. And that's how our minds would normally view maybe physical, mental, or emotional energy. We might say put it into compartments, but it's all related.
Okay, so what you're saying, I just want to see if I understand.
Sure.
So as the energy increases, It could manifest as physical, emotional, or mental energy. And as it does, our character develops so that we can handle a greater amount of energy on each of those levels appropriately as well.
Yes.
Thank you.
That's good. Can I get that down? Well, Cliff will have it on the team. Thank you. Yes?
I have a question, because you asked whether we experience this or manifest this in our practice. So when you said in our practice, that kind of set me back a little, because I don't know exactly what you mean by in our practice. I mean, does that mean in our practice versus some other time, or do you mean just in our practice versus theoretically? I mean, are we always practicing, or is there a time we're practicing and a time we're not practicing?
Well, I think that's in maybe your own view of when, but for me, practice is life. Life is practice. You know, there's no separation in that. But people might say, "Well, I'm intensifying my practice by doing a sesshin." So there's probably more than one way you could use that word, and how it would be more contextual in use, but you can use it as the entire thing or specific.
So in your question, what were you asking?
Well, because you're all here, I'm assuming your practice is your life. So, does it show up in your practice?
So you could say, does it show up in your life?
Yes, you could. But we're using Buddhist terms, so... That's all. No difference. Did that help?
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
Yes, Joe.
Not sure exactly what my question is, but this has been really relevant lately. So, like a year ago, I had to give the control of my life over to others, and that was very difficult for me. And so I learned to let go of, you know, I thought I'm just going to let go of my energy, because it was painful, you know, because I, you know, there was a lot of, I want this and I want that. And then I noticed as I come back, like the road here has been very metaphorical, because I start in the valley, I live in Davis, and I there's one kind of energy that brings me to San Jose on the train, and then I've got to climb the hill here. And I've just noticed that in order to make it up that hill, like there was something missing. And so I started, it was like, and then it was, oh yeah, it was that, the exact energy that I had set aside. And so San Jose begins with the headphones and this rap music that I never listened to rap, but all of a sudden, in order to make it up that hill.
On his bicycle.
So in order to make it up the hill, it's like I call up this, you know, it's kind of like go back and get the that kind of energy. But then when I arrive here, it's like for the first couple months, you know, I'm just aware it's kind of frightening, because this energy isn't, there's a lot of it seems to be ego. I mean, rap is ego-driven, and yet, as the ride goes on, finally there's some exhaustion, and then you're just pedaling. But then when I arrive here, it seems like that energy has got to be completely burned up. Like, it's necessary to come up the hill. It's part of being part of Jokoji. But yet it's not appropriate in this little valley. So I've been thinking lately that energy needs to be called up appropriate for a situation burned up completely before the next situation arises. and like how often I'm even frightened of my own energy. Mm. You know, like, you know, I don't know. I was wondering if you had anything to say about that. Because it's just been active.
Well, your awareness is fine-tuned to energy cycles. Uh-huh. And so you're seeing expressions and, or, you know, the actual application and then, you know, using it up. I was thinking of the image of the lotus in the fire, of, you know, how one is, there's the energy of the fire, but you're not consumed. So that image may help with, instead of totally exhausting yourself, you know, for some kinds, yes, you know, we want to exercise and burn up that energy, right? Because that helps the body actually process. And other times it may be that through the different kinds of energy that are brought up by the situation, that it may not follow that same course of totally being burnt up. So I don't know. You'll have to, sounds to me like it's like a self-discovery of energy. And since you had made such a conscious choice to set aside energy last year, so now it's being rediscovered. Which is, you know, I think actually an expression of your practice, the intensity of your practice to start, you know, experiencing the energy again. Yes, Chris.
I'm a little confused about this paramita.
Mm-hmm.
Is the paramita about managing energy? Because I understand generosity, and I understand morality, but energy seems to be something that just is.
Mm-hmm.
So, what is my role in that perfection?
Well, I think your role in that is in terms of developing, you know, if we're looking at paramitas in relationship to character development, and it's like, what kind? Yeah, energy comes. It's a natural arising, and then it comes actually through applied effort.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about, like, I'm doing mindfulness practices as a way of intensifying your own practice, because you're ready to do that. You know when you're ready to do that. You choose to do that. You choose to intensify your practice in different things, whether it's coming to live at Jokoji, whether it's sitting, you know, for a 5-day sesshin. These are all choices you are making that are in effect modifying, you know, and refining your character. And by those choices that you're making, energy is created, and you can continue to experience that energy. You maybe haven't tuned in to the energy that is really sustaining you, and because you're still here and you're still, you know, doing this intense practice, so it might be more of an awareness about that energy and to see how it's actually sustaining you when through courage, you know, helping you pull that courage out of yourself to sustain your practice when your family situation changes.
So, through mindfulness, you know, in a sense, get in touch with that energy and develop it, or I don't know how you develop energy, but
well, actually, you're only developing. You're in mindfulness. You're developing awareness.
Awareness,
right? And energy is that you could say is more of a byproduct of of what's going on. But through awareness, you actually become aware of your energy. Mm-hmm. You know, there is a lightness in your life that comes with confidence. Mm-hmm. And happiness, a level of happiness. Mm-hmm. As Bree has pointed out, so how she have observed in her own life some significant changes. And, you know, this comes about through energy. It's just part of the stages, and it's just something to tune into and see how it helps you grow and sustain yourself in this practice.